getting to the slowly to the end of the lecture course. In fact, I won't be around next Friday, but Peter will give the last lecture. And the last big topic will be amortized complexity, and we will cover much of that today already. So I assume that you've heard about amortized complexity. We'll still go through the basics again, but of course with an emphasis on functional programming and proofs. So what is that? First, the motivation. Here's the standard example. If you have a binary counter and you increment that binary counter n times, starting with zero, and you ask yourself, how expensive is that? Well, one way of approaching is you first figure out the worst case complexity of a single increment, and of course that is the length of the bit of the counter at that time. The length, and the length is the logarithm of the maximal length. So this is a really conservative estimate, because you're taking n increments, and at the very end, of course, the counter has length log n, and then the worst case complexity of a single increment is just having to go through the whole sequence of bits and flip all the ones to zeros. And how many of increments do you have? Well, n, and therefore you have the worst case complexity n times log n, and that's a really bad estimate, and it's really too pessimistic, because many of those increments are actually quite cheap, because they just need to increment the very first bit, and then they're done, because that's already a zero, and so that can help to pay for the more expensive increments, where you really have to go through the whole list of ones until you come to the front of the number. And so it turns out that the worst case complexity of n increments is actually linear in n, rather than n log n. And in order to explain that, you need amortized complexity. So the problem with the naive version is that you estimate each individual operation, but then you just multiply it by the number of operations, and that's an overestimation, because some of them can be much cheaper, and then in totality, even in the worst case, it can be cheaper than this product. And so what we try to determine is the average cost, but that doesn't mean average in the sense of average over possible inputs, but it really means in the worst case. Average means over a sequence of operations, and then the worst case that can happen, but then what did each operation cost in on average? And you use the cheap operations to pay for the expensive ones in order to get an average. And the method is, the intuitive method is that the cheap operations pay extra. You can think of it paying into a bank account, making them more expensive, getting them closer to the average, and the expensive operations withdraw money from the bank account to make them cheaper, to also get them close to the average. And the bank account is always a bit of an intuitive notion. The more formal notion is that of a potential, where you don't have a separate bank, but you have your data structure, and all the things that you've paid in are in the data structure, in the potential of the data structure. So, that's the idea, that this credit that you've accumulated over time is implicitly stored in the data structure, and the potential is therefore a function from the data structure to some non-negative number. The potential can't become zero, negative. And it tells us up to with the operations leading up to that state in the data of the data structure, how much credit was stored in the data structure. And increase the potential then means that you have you have paid something into the data structure to pay for later expensive operations. So you probably performed some cheap operation that allowed you to increase the potential, and the potential can later on be used to pay for restructuring the data structure. And the decrease of potential means that you're now in a situation where you need to reorganize the data structure, but in order to keep the costs down, you take some of the costs from the potential, so you lower the potential of the data structure. And so now let's see this quite concretely, how that works for the counter. So how much does the increment cost? Well, we assume one time unit for each bit flip, and then what are the bank transactions? Well, when you do flip a one, what you do is you pay in one for the final 0 to 1 flip. So you go through a sequence of ones, flip them all to zero, and the final one, then you get to a zero or to the front of the list, and you flip that zero to a one, and then you pay in one for future savings. And when you take out one, you take out one when you flip the ones to the zeros. So that's the intuitive idea in a bank transaction. And therefore, the increment has amortized cost 2. Why? Because you... don't understand my slide completely anymore. Oh, right. Yes. The actual cost is one for each bit flip. But here you can pay for these bit flips by taking something out of the bank account. And then you do have to pay one for the final bit flip, but one is it, why is it then not just one? Two? Maybe the rest of the slide. The end result is certainly true. The increment has amortized cost 2, but what is the reasoning in terms of the bank account? Actual cost 1 for each bit flip? Yes. For each bit flip, it's 1. So it's 1 for this final bit flip of 0 to 1 is an actual cost, plus you pay into the bank account 1, so that's where the 2 comes in. But all the initial costs where you flip out, where you take out 1s for the flipping 1 to 0 in the prefix of 1s, you don't pay anything because that is paid for by the bank account. Yeah. So this is the 1 plus 1 is the 1 that you pay in plus the 1 for the bit flip. And these, all the ones of the ones leading up to it, are paid out of the bank account. Of course, you have to make sure that the bank account has enough money in it. So this is where how we do it formally. The potential of a counter is the number of ones in the counter. So you just look at the whole counter and you take all the number of ones in there. And then this should be the amount of ones that you've yes, right, because the ones are these ones where you've flipped a 0 to a 1. So if you count them, that's exactly the potential is exactly what you paid into the bank account at this point here. And now formalization. In general, so this was a specific example. Now let's look at the general situation. You have some data structure like the bit list Assume it has type tau, and then you have one or more operations on it. Here we just had the increment operation, and it goes from tau to tau. It may also have other arguments, like if you insert something into a data structure, but that's the basic skeleton. It takes the data structure and creates a new version of the data structure. And you have some initial value, and that's it. And so this is the implementation. What you need for the amortized analysis of the implementation, you need a time and cost function for each operation. This is the standard notation that we use, T_F, that maps the data structure to some numeric value and tells you how expensive is it to execute operation F on this data structure, how much real time does it cost you? And num is some numeric type, and we'll see that nat is not always the best choice, so we will also use other types there. And the potential function that maps a data structure also to this numeric domain, and here we need some creativity to come up with that, you needed all of this thinking here to come that the bank account, you pay in for something, you take out for something, and then you say, oh yes, according to this mental model, the potential should be the number of ones in the counter. But that's something where you really have to think about the data structure. And you have to prove two things, that the potential is never negative and that it's initially zero. And if you have those properties, then you can actually derive that the amortized cost is an upper bound for the real cost. So let's assume we have a sequence of operations F1 to Fn performed on the data structure, starting with some initial state, S0, which is set by the init function. And then you keep on applying these operations F1 up to Fn from the interface of your data structure, and you keep modifying the data structure. Well, you don't really modify your inner functional setting, but we'll talk about that in a moment. S1 is the result of applying F1 to S0, and so on. Sn is the result of applying Fn to the previous state. And then you define the amortized cost as the real cost plus the potential difference, potential meaning I think we have it on the next line. Yes, here it is. So the amortized cost is the real cost. This is what the timing function tells us. How expensive was it to execute this operation on this state? Plus the difference in potential, meaning the new potential minus the old potential of the data structure. And so this is what I call the amortized cost of executing operation i+1 on state I. And then you can easily show that the sum of all the amortized costs for all the calls here, each call has an amortized cost, and then the sum of the amortized costs will be greater than or equal the sum of the real costs, so it's really an upper bound for the real cost. And why is that? Well, the sum of all the amortized costs is the sum of all of these terms here, the actual time, plus the potential difference. But if you sum that up from 1 to n, almost every potential will occur both positively and negatively, positively in one term and negatively in the next one, and then that will just cancel each other out. So they will all cancel out, except for the very first potential and the very last potential. So the very first potential will only occur negatively here, and the very last one will occur only positively there. And so if you, this is called telescoping, if you take that into account, then you just have the sum over the real costs plus the potential difference of the very last potential minus the very first potential, and that was by assumption zero, and that's always positive, and so that means the sum of the real times is actually this whole term is an upper bound of this term. So that's the compressed derivation, why the sum of the amortized costs is really the sum of the real costs. So if you think in terms of the amortized cost, you do have an upper bound on the real costs. And so what you do, what you have to verify in order to verify that your amortized cost is really something or other, you need for each operation F some amortized, some upper bound for the amortized cost. Let's call that A underscore F. That again takes the data structure to a numeric value. And then you have to prove that these the claimed upper bound is really an upper bound, that it's above the amortized cost, namely the real cost plus the potential difference. So this is what you, this is where you really have to prove put some potentially difficult theorems to show that either, well, this could, if you're lucky, you can not just find an upper bound, but you can find an exact solution. So you can find, you can prove that this term here is equal to this term, but more often than not, it's just a less than or equal. And the typical examples will be that we have some constant here, or we have some logarithmic term. Those are the two examples that we will need. So now let's go back to the counter, and let's treat the counter with exactly this framework. So we have each operation, well, there's only one operation that takes a counter to a counter, and this is the definition. Empty list is increment, when you increment that, you just get the single true. And when you increment a list that starts with a false, well, the false is flipped to a true. And if you have one that starts with a true, then the true is flipped to a false, but then you have to increment the rest of the list. So you just go through the list until you've finally reached a false, and you flip that to a true, or you go to the very front of the list when you also replace that by true. And the init is the empty state, so the empty list. And the potential, I said, is just supposed to be the number of ones, which means the number of trues in the list. And this is a compact way of writing that. So you just filter out all the elements in BS that take all the elements that are true. And, well, you just need the identity function and then test the result. And then you just take the length that tells you how many elements in the list were true. And then it's actually quite simple to prove this potential difference plus actual cost is equal to 2. And that was precisely what we claimed initially when we went, let's go back here. So here we had some informal reasoning why that is the case, why the amortized cost is 2, and now this is really being proved formally. And it's a simple proof by induction. Yep.
So I apologize for asking a dumb question, but in the way that you implemented it right here, if you were trying to increment on a single list of the element true, wouldn't you get false true, which is the same thing you started, or is it red, white,
and black? Hang on.
I'm just trying to think, like, an example, if you're trying to add increment to 1, you should get 1, 0.
Yes.
Right?
What is 1 in your?
Just binary 1. Just true.
Yes. And how would you, what list is that? True.
True.
Yes.
And so you would get 0, 1, instead of 1, 0. Or do you read it right to left?
Well, assume you've taken computer science 101 and you understand that what a binary encoding is and how increment works. Where does increment start? From the least or the most significant bit? You tell me which one does it start from, the least or the most significant bit? I think go back to term one. Increment, I'm afraid, starts from the least significant bit. I don't really want to repeat computer science 101. Any other question? So this is the summary of the proof obligation. You have to prove the potential is always positive, negative, and initially zero, and that for each operation, this amortized cost is really bounded by your claimed amortized cost. So, in addition, your data structure may have an invariant, in which case all of these proof obligations are preceded by the precondition that your invariant holds. So you can take advantage of that. And in some cases, your data structure may not just take a single data structure, but it may actually take two data structures, for example, some union operation. And then, I'm not going to justify this, but informally it makes sense. So then it takes a bit longer to read. So what is this? This is your actual argument, your function is f, and this is the time it takes to execute f on these two data structures, S1 and S2, plus some other arguments. So for generality, I have added the possibility of having more arguments there, not just those two data structures. But of course, these other arguments aren't supposed to be data structures, but they're just some auxiliary variable, some auxiliary arguments like numbers or the elements that you want to insert into the data structure. And then it's again the potential difference, the potential afterwards, that's just the result of executing the operation on these arguments that we had, minus the potential before, but now we had two data structures before, so we need to subtract both potentials. And then we have to show that, again, the bound that we gave is an upper bound for this whole sum, this one, plus this potential difference. And the potential difference may, of course, be negative. And with that remark, you can also infer why the natural numbers are not always a good fit for the potential. Because if you do that, if you have, say, these are natural numbers, then if you have a subtraction in here, or in there, it doesn't matter, and the potential and the time are natural numbers, then you really you have to take the sum of these and then subtract something. You can't take this minus this, because that may be negative, but there are no negative natural numbers, so you get into problems with algebraic manipulations of these terms. So this is a point, and in fact a general point, once you have you're using subtraction on some numeric value, it's probably cumbersome to work with the natural numbers because they behave irregularly on subtraction. You can't use all your usual algebraic laws, and so that's why the natural numbers are in this situation, because of the minus, not a good fit. You can do it, but then you're always forced into case distinctions. Oh, is it really big enough so I can subtract it? And that's just unpleasant. Right. Now, this is the first warning. If you have an amortized data structure, it's typically not suitable for real-time applications. Why is that? Because each individual call may have a very wide very wide variance in the time it takes, and it can be much worse than the amortized time. Think of the counter. If you're just in the bad situation that you have a counter of all ones and you increment, and then in a time-critical moment, it may just take too long. So that's why they have to be used with care in real-time applications, because you can't predict them very well. You can predict the overall running time, but not of each individual one. And second warning, this analysis really assumes that the data structure is used in a single-threaded way. Single-threaded means here that you don't use the same data structure twice. So no value is used more than once. So it's like a thread that goes through your program, and you pass that data structure through the program, and you don't come to a point where you fork it, where you say, well, I pass the data structure to this function, but I also pass it to that function. That would be a bad idea to do that. Why? Because then you could get into this situation. You set the counter to zero, you initialize it, and then you increment it to the point where you just have this long sequence of ones. And then you increment this value once, which takes a long time. And then you increment it again and again and again. And each of them take a long time. And therefore, your amortized complexity estimate goes out of the window because you kept on reusing that badly behaved data structure. Whereas if you had only used this bad once, like here, and then continued with the result of it, then you would have been fine because the result would have, again, had almost zero potential and wouldn't have taken a long while to work on. But this is not single-threaded because you're reusing bad more than once. You're not just using it here, but also using it here and here. So that means amortized analysis is really has an imperative flavor in the sense that although you don't, strictly speaking, need to destroy the data structure, you can't reuse it. Unless you want to. I mean, you can reuse it, but then your complexity estimates are no longer valid. So that's the second warning about amortized complexity. And the third one is about, that's just a little warning, observer functions. So far, we've pretended that all the operations on our data structure are of the form they take the data structure and they also return the data structure. But that's not necessarily the case. There are observer functions which merely take the data structure, like they want to see whether some element is in the set, but they don't return a changed data structure. They just return a Boolean value. And here, we have to be a bit careful with the complexity analysis because well, the potential difference is zero because you haven't changed the data structure. So the potential before is the same as the potential after because you didn't return a new value. And so that means the amortized cost is really the real cost. And with these observer functions, you really have to work in terms of their actual cost. You can't do any kind of fancy amortized analysis. So here, it's the usual worst-case complexity analysis of the observer function, and not you can't take any potential into account here. And that makes sense because the observer functions shouldn't consume their arguments. It would be quite silly if you have an observer function like a test whether the set is empty, and once you've tested the set whether it's empty, the set is gone, you've used it. That would be completely pointless. So observer functions should be allowed to do what we saw on the previous slide was not a good idea. So you should be able to do this. You create some bad version of the data structure, which is very unbalanced, has a high potential. And then you call the observer function repeatedly on it. You ask whether the data structure is empty or something. That, because you're using worst case complexity and not amortized complexity here, it doesn't matter. You should be allowed to do it, and you are allowed to do it because of this caveat. And those, I think, are the three important things that I wanted to say about the warnings. It's not so practical for real time. It's single-threaded, and observers have a separate... They don't come into the amortized analysis, the observers. You really have to take their actual runtime into account. Right, and now I would like to go through a number of simple classical examples, and well, actually only three of them, and show how you model them in this functional setting and how you actually verify their complexity in this functional setting. And two of them I'm sure you've seen before, but probably not the third one. So let me increase the font size a bit. Is that readable or should I further? Is it readable or should I increase it? Sorry.
It's okay.
Thank you. Yeah. So this is the binary counter. And we have seen the functions already on the slide, except for the timing function. So here I've just spelled out the time again. So it just reflects the recursive call structure of the increment function, the t increment. And then the potential is, as on the slide, the number of ones, which means you filter with the identity function and you take the length. And then the two obligations that we have for the potential function, they should be easy to prove. This is right. Why is it always greater or equal zero? Well, right. Here you see, by the way, I have made the potential function a function into the integers to avoid this numeric problem with the natural numbers. And in case you wonder why can I just write this length, because length returns a natural number, but I'm claiming it's an integer. Remember that if you start with complex main, so you've got the real and the complex numbers and everything, then in that theory, coercions are inserted automatically. So if you later on look at this definition, let's open the output window, and let's look at the theorem. Wrong one. Then you see up down there, the system has inserted the coercion from nat to int. And so, but the existing lemmas, there is a lemma that the conversion of a natural number into an integer will always be greater or equal to zero. So this was not a hard proof. And that it's initially zero is also not a hard proof, because initially it's the empty list, and the length of the empty list, even after filtering, will still be zero. And so the only interesting one is this one, which relates the actual cost for the increment with the potential difference, and says that the sum of the actual cost and the potential difference is 2. So here our upper bound is in fact a precise upper bound, it's just equality, and then the proof is by induction on the bit string BS, and it just works. So we can now use this as a starting point to prove this, something that we saw on the slide. Let's just go back to the slide. Here we had this little derivation that said the sum of the amortized costs is the same as the sum of the real costs, so the sum of the amortized costs is greater or equal to sum of real costs. We proved that generically for any collection of operations. We can prove that also concretely for our binary incrementer. So we define an auxiliary function increments with an s at the end that increments in starting counter n times. Yeah. So if you increment it 0 times, you get the same counter back. And if you increment it success of n times, well, you increment it once, and then you again increment it n times. So that's just setting up what on the slide is the first line here. You start with init, and then you keep on applying the operation to it n times. We have just one operation. And now I'm doing this concretely for our example. Here is abstractly. And then the time for all the increments is then just summing up T increment for all the intermediate data structures. So if you don't do anything, then the time it takes is zero. And if you do n plus one increments, then it's the time for the increment plus the rest of the time. So it's just a recursive phrasing of the sum. So if we go back here to the slide, it would be this summation here, the sum of all the real costs. That's the T increment, the sum of all the real costs. And then you can show that the real time is now bounded, well, exactly 2 times n, the length of how many increments it did. And this is the potential difference negatively. Why? Well, this is just another way of saying that the real time plus this potential difference from the very first to the very last is 2 times n. So that's another way of reading it. Or you can say, well, the real time is 2 times n plus something. And that something, well, that something is actually going to be, well, that depends. Yeah. So here it gives you a precise phrasing of the real time. And now you really see the real time is linear in the number of bits that you have, plus something else, and we have to figure out what that something else is. Well, this proof is simply, that's where the telescoping takes place that I talked about on the slide when I said, here, these are all the sums of the real time plus the potential difference, and then they cancel out the positive and the negative terms, and you just are left with the very first one and the very last one and the very first one. And here it looks slightly differently because we have, instead of having this potential difference over here, we have it on the other side. But it tells you it's really linear plus something else, and that something else we can get rid of in a moment, because here we had the version where we start from some arbitrary initial state. We don't start from the empty list. We start from some arbitrary bit list. I think we need that because otherwise the induction will not go through. And then you can now derive the actual time it takes to do n increments from starting from init as bounded by 2 to the n. Why? Because if bs is the empty string, then the potential at the very beginning is 0, and you subtract something which you know is positive. And so therefore, if you subtract something positive from 2n, that's of course less than 2n, less than or equal to 2n, so that's why we get that. So this is just concretely proving this abstract amortized real complexity relation. And I'm not going to do that again. I'm just, in a sense, confirming that what we did here on that slide works. But of course, we wouldn't really need that confirmation. But it just shows that here it's very abstract, and that's here we're talking about some arbitrary set of operations. But then it's harder to prove that theorem in generality. Whereas here, when you have a concrete instance that counters, then you know exactly what the operations are, and you can phrase the theorem quite precisely. But now, sorry, we go back here, because now we continue with the examples. And the next one are the so-called dynamic tables, which is actually a practically quite useful technique that, like Java libraries, for example, use. If you want to have an array that's extensible, so you can say, please give me more, then what you do is, you do the following. Every time you add a new element, if you still have space, I mean, you add a new element in the sense of increasing the size of the array. If you still have space, you just you don't need to do anything, so then it's for free. But once you run out of space, then you really have to do something, and at that point you double the size of the array and completely copy it into the next into this space that's twice as large. So that's, you don't need to do the doubling. You can use other factors, but then the analysis becomes a bit more complicated. So that's why in a teaching context, it's always the doubling, because that's easiest to analyze. And of course, I think if you do something below 2, I think then you may run into trouble, but I'm not quite sure about that. 1.5 might also work. So I'm pretty sure that above 2 it also works, but below 2, I think it will work for anything above 1. Yeah, I think it will. But then it just becomes more unpleasant. And so in order to analyze this situation, we abstract from it. So we just want to do the analysis. We don't show the actual code of this allocating space and then copying, but we just do an abstract analysis where we say, well, what is such a table really? We're not interested in the actual content of the table, because the operations of extending the table by an element or looking up something, they're completely independent of what you're looking up. So all you're interested in is the size of things. So how large is my table currently, and how much of the space have I actually occupied? So how much space have I allocated, and how much space have I occupied? Those are basically the two values that you need. And then whenever you need a bit more space, you need to increment how much space do I use. And at some point, you've used up all that you've allocated, and then the doubling needs to take place. And so that's why our type synonym for a table is simply a pair of natural numbers. And here the n is the number of elements that are actually used, and l is the length of your array that you've allocated. And our invariant naturally will be that we can have a never more elements that are actually used than the space that is allocated. So l is the length, and n is the number of elements that we have allocated in that length. And we start with the table where we haven't allocated anything. So, and then the insert function, we say we want to insert another element in the table. So it's like an increment. We want to increase the table by one. And then the table is just this pair of n and l. So n is definitely increased by one. We have one more element in the table. But now, do we need to change the size of the full table? If our n is still below l, then we still have one more space, so we don't need to do anything. Our l part of the, so this is the return tuple, the new sizes of the table. And if the number of elements used is less than the number of elements allocated, then we don't need to change the allocation. We just stay with l. And otherwise, if we need to do something, if the n is actually, well, it can't be greater than l, but it could be equal to l. If n is actually equal to l, then there's a special case. If the length is zero, then we have never allocated anything. Then we need set the size to one, so we allocate one cell. And otherwise, we double the cell, the size of the array. So now it's 2 times l. So that's the abstract behavior of what an insert operation into the table does. So we assume here we're treating only insert operations that actually increase the size of the table. So you might actually call that an increment operation, where you explicitly say, I want to increment the size of my array by one. And if you just want to access the array in its current bounds, then that operation is uninteresting, because it doesn't change the, it doesn't do any allocation or deallocation. And so now we need to figure out what the time is for these, for this insert operation. So that's this one. And it refers to the time that this operation takes. And now, of course, you need to be aware of the abstraction that you're making, because in terms of the numbers, not much is happening, but we're not interested in the numbers. We're interested in what happens in the background with the actual storage. And so here, this time to insert another element in a table where we have n elements already used and a table of size l. If n is less than l, then the time is just 1, because you can just So you just do a little local operation that says, oh, yeah, I'm occupying a little bit more space here, and I copy that element into that one more space, but I already have enough. So I have enough space, so I don't need to do anything. And otherwise, it's n plus 1. Why? Because otherwise, you need to double the table. We assume here for simplicity that the actual allocation of the new table, just requesting the storage for a table twice that size, is 0. That's a bit of a stretch, but it's not too... it should be something close to a constant. It shouldn't depend on how much space you allocate, unless you get really, really big. But, of course, what you do have to count is the time it takes to copy the old array into the new array of twice the size. And so that's why we have n plus 1. So n was the old size, because we're now in the case that n is equal to l, and plus 1 because we have one more element that we put into it. So that's why we arrive at this simple situation. And then we can easily prove the invariance. So we do need the invariant here, that n is less or equal l. We can prove that it's true initially, and that it's preserved by the insert operation. So that's just auxiliary stuff. And now what is the potential? And, well, you go and look it up in Korman, Lysis, and Rivest, and it tells you that the potential should be 2 times n minus l. So the 2 times is already suggests it's got something to do with doubling, but it's. I don't want to give you the precise motivation precisely because I assume you have been through amortized analysis in an undergraduate course already. So I want to focus on the handling in this context and not the precise motivation. So this one works, and right. So what do we do here? I'm saying something about natural numbers. So in this case, the potential is intentionally a natural number. Everything so far, everything has been a natural number. And we stick with the natural numbers, and you may wonder why or if this is a good potential. It is a good potential. Well, for a start, since it's a natural number, by definition it won't be negative, but also it will never be negative because the n... Oh, no, hang on. It can be negative. If it were an integer, it could be negative, but they're all natural numbers. Precisely, if you have a very small n here and you subtract the big L from it, it can happen. But only, I think, in this special case when you start. Or can it also happen later on? What does the text say? 2 can be less than L. Okay. The invariant does not exclude this case, although it cannot arise. Because the invariant only tells us that... What is the invariant? That n is less than or equal L. It doesn't tell us that... I mean, a really nice invariant would be that n is always between L is between, yes, what is the precise invariant for this data structure? It's certainly n is less or equal L, but there's another relation that will hold. Yeah. Yes. So the equality is, well, almost reached at the point where you just doubled, and then the n becomes bigger until it reaches L again, and then you double, and then you're again in this situation. So this would be the complete invariant. And with that complete invariant, you would actually know that 2n minus L is always positive. And so this corner case of subtraction on natural numbers doesn't really happen, but it doesn't follow from the weak invariant that we have used. On the other hand, it appears we don't need it. So probably the proofs will somehow go through without it. And then you prove that the invariant implies that it's always positive. Well, this is trivial. In fact, I don't think we need a case distinction here because the potential goes into the natural numbers. So yes, in fact, I think the system tells us where is it output? It says something that this can be solved directly, so we don't need this one. I think this is a leftover from the time when we had an integer there. And now, yeah, so the case distinction wasn't necessary. Initially it's zero, yep. And then this is the interesting bit. Now we are putting forward an upper bound for the real cost minus the potential, plus the potential difference. So I'm claiming that the time it takes to insert plus the potential difference of potential afterwards minus potential before is actually constant. And so that is the amortized time. So the claim here is that although you have this expensive doubling operation, you can pay for that by all the, in fact, almost free operations when you, all the increments up to that doubling pay for the cost of the doubling. And that kind of makes sense if you put some constant amount for each increment of the size of the table, then you have done that n times, and in when you double, you just have to pay those n units to copy all the n elements. So that's also intuitively a sensible estimate. And finally, and this is now really pure functional programming, is a queue, where you put things in at one end and you take them out at the other end. And the standard, well, the naive implementation of a queue is just a list, and there you have the problem. It's either cheap to put things into the list if you put them in at the front, but then it's expensive to get them at the end of the list, or the other way around. So you always have one of the two operations being linear time, which is not nice. And then there is this very well-known representation of a queue as a pair of lists. So this is what we're using here. This is a special purpose implementation of a queue. And the idea is the following. So you have these two queues, two lists, or two stacks is actually a good way to think about them. Back and front. And when you enqueue something, enqueue an element, then you enqueue it into the back. You just put it in front of the back, so back here. And if you dequeue something, you take it out of the front of the queue. And again, you just take the first element here, you put it in front of the list, you put it as a, with a big expect, a non-empty list, so that you can take the first element away from it, and that's the dequeue operation. So if this is X's and this is Y's, then the abstract queue that you're thinking of is, well, it depends on which way around your queue is, but let's assume the queue is so that the front is the newest one, and the, sorry, front and back is better. Yeah, see, on the left end of the list is the newest elements, and on the right end of the list are the oldest elements. Then the abstraction function would abstract those two together to axis append reverse of y's. So the ones that are here at the front, if you reverse them, they will really go all the way here and they will end up at the right end of the list, at the end of the list, and those are the, so this is the new, and this is old. And you've now managed to make both of these operations, enq and eq, very fast. It just takes a cons operation to enq something, and the opposite of a cons, a head operation to deq something. But what's the price? There's a price. It's not just completely constant time. There's one situation where it becomes non-constant time. Yeah?
Yeah. Why is this nil?
Pardon?
Why is this nil?
Right. Because you keep on taking things out of this, and eventually that will be empty. And at that point, you need to move some of the stuff or all of it into here, and then you pay for all the cheap operations. And so that's the idea. And so this is the formalization here. So the initial empty q, both parts are empty. If you enq, you just cons the element in front of the list of the part, the back part. And the dq is the one that is potentially expensive. So if your front part, the y's, is empty, then you have to do something about it. Then you completely reverse the axis and take the tail, because you're dequeuing. And so you basically take all these elements of x's, put them into y's, but you have to reverse them, because here this list starts with the newest element, and you don't want that as the frontier, but you need it just reversed. So that's why this ref is there. On the other hand, you may be lucky, and y's is not empty, and typically for a long time you are lucky, and then you can just take the tail of y's. So that's, again, a constant time operation, but this is a linear time operation in terms of the size of the back part of the queue. And the timing, here we assume that the time for enq is 1. Well, that's because we have made the assumption we count only the number of newly allocated list cells. So just like in sorting, people often just count the comparisons. Here we just count the list cells. And that's not too ridiculous, because it can happen in functional programming. It depends a little bit on your runtime system and the compiler, but often the cost of some storage allocation operation, in this case a const cell, dominates, and other operations like adding 1 or something is completely irrelevant, because with the when you allocate some storage, then this may typically or can cause some some cache miss, and so then you really pay for it. So the enq operation is cheap. We just count this cons operation here. Dq, of course, is a bit more complicated. And here we just say, well, there are no allocated cons cells. It looks like it, but of course we have a reverse operation. The reverse operation can be implemented in linear time, and it will just create a new list, and therefore it will allocate all of these cons cells for the new list. So the cost of the dq operation, if we are in this situation here, is just the length of the size of the axis part, because that's how much reversal you need to do. Whereas here we are liberal and say this is completely for free, this tail, because we're not allocating anything on the heap. And so this is why we get this dq function that we have here. That if the front is empty, then we really have to do something, and then it's just the length of the back that needs to be reversed, and otherwise it's zero, nothing else allocated. And it turns out that a good potential is the length of the back. Does anybody have an intuitive explanation of why that is a good potential? Remember, the length of the back is the potential is something like the bank account. So you've paid something into the bank account. Why should you pay exactly the length into the bank account? Yeah. Yes, yeah, so that's the motivation. You want to pay for the DQ operation that may reverse the excess, so you just take the length of excess, which is, of course, a very nice potential, because then you can also say, well, the excess gets built up one by one by each in queue. You just pay one into the account. You just make the potential one bigger, and therefore you now have just intuitively a very nice bound for, in fact, the precise number, or is it about, I'm not sure, for the cost of the DQ operation, and for the in queue for the in queue operation, it's two, one for the actual cost and one for the paying into the bank account, which gets you this potential of the length. And then the DQ operation can take all of that out, and I think it's then 0, 1 or something like that. We'll see that. Yes, so the potential is always non-negative, it's initial zero, and yes, here we have the potential difference, the amortized cost for the EQ is the actual cost for the EQ plus the potential difference, and it happens to be two, and that's exactly what we informally argued, the amortized cost of in queue should be two, because one for the actual cost and one for the later cost of reversing that element. And here you actually have an example where the amortized cost of the DQ operation is zero, which is kind of funny because the DQ is the more expensive one. But of course, it's just because everything that the DQ costs has already been paid for in advance by all the in queue operations. So it can happen that you have amortized costs that are zero, but you have paid for them already beforehand. So, right. So that brings me almost to the end. But my question is now, how can we model access to the front of the queue? Because we have a very limited repertoire only. We have the in queue and the DQ operation, but the DQ operation just throws out that element. If you go back to the DQ operation, here it is. This is the line. And, well, you just see, just look at the type. It just removes the element from the queue, but it never gives you that element. Now, of course, a typical a queue would also have, a front operation that gives you the front of the queue, the front element of the queue. Now, how could we model this here in our implementation? This is a baby implementation that can be. So how could you implement some functionality that also gives you the front element of the queue? Just first in principle, there are two possibilities how to realize that. Yeah. Yes, that's quite a frequent the trick. So here you would return a pair of the queue and an element. And then here, what do we do? Then we need to, if it's empty, blah, 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 tail, it's tail. So we probably want to let y, why not, y s prime equals, what's the best, shortest way to do this? Well, we can just do it in here without being too clever about it. So we return a pair of the queue, but the queue itself is a pair already. So and the element, and in this case, it'll be, well, this, of course, wouldn't be a good idea. This is too naive, because now you would reverse the queue twice. So you would at least want to do this, let y s prime equal ref of, or let me call that x s prime. And then you return the tail of x's prime here and the head of x's prime. So now I think let blah, blah, blah in blah. I think that should be okay. Of course, it doesn't, it's still objecting because we haven't done anything here. And here it's simpler. Here we can just return the head of x's, y's, sorry. That is a perfectly acceptable implementation. Alternatively, we could also have a separate front function that gives you that element whenever you want to see it. Let's look at that implementation. Front. So now it just takes the queue and gives you back an element. Yeah, and now, of course, if it's empty, then you have to take the head of reverse of x's, and otherwise you take the head of y's. That's certainly functionally correct. That's the right way to deal with the front operation. But it's not very satisfactory. Why not? It works, but it's not as efficient as it could be. What's the problem? Yes, and even worse, because front is an observer, you could call front many, many times on a queue that has the empty front, and you would every time reverse it. So it's even a bit worse than you said. So how could we deal with this if we really want these three functions? You have to modify the implementation a bit. You have to avoid this unpleasant situation that the front is faced with the empty front. Yeah? Right. So when you enqueue something and you notice that your front has become empty because some dequeue operation, for example, or because of some front operation, then you already do your reverse. So in fact, let's call this create a separate function. Let's call that funCheck, which takes such a pair and checks if the first, if the right part of the pair is empty, and then already performs the reversal. So I'm not giving the type for, because I'm too lazy. Check of x's and y's. And do we do with it? Let's do it with the, if this is empty, then you make this empty and reverse the axis, and otherwise check for any other Q. It's just the Q itself. Okay, so now when we call inQ, we don't just inQ it like that, we also call the check function on it to make sure that it doesn't leave behind a Q with an empty front. And if we dQ, then I think we can simplify things a little bit. So dQ, let's write that differently. Now we can assume it's non-empty. Well, we can't really assume that the front is non-empty, because in the worst case, there's nothing at all in the queue. But then it's kind of like, then it's up to the user who's called dQ at the wrong moment. Well, you should really have a separate error handling if you're asked, if you're dQing something from the empty queue. But let's leave that out of the picture. So if you have this situation, then what do you do? Well, you remove the Y, and then you just call the check function on the remainder. Listen to this. So what do we call the check function on? Just on the pair X's Y's. And I think that should be the correct implementation. And now the front operation will not do any reversal. The front operation also assumes we have something there, and then we just return that. So this would be the from a complexity point of view, the right implementation. If you want to have a separate front function, then you know as long as there is something in the queue, then it'll be there will be the front part will be non-empty, and you can assume that, of course, ignoring the error situation where there's really nothing in the queue. But the check function ensures this, that after you've called it, it really the front part of the queue is non-empty. Well, unless the queue itself is completely empty. And then, so this is the caveat with observer functions, that they can be called multiple times, and therefore they shouldn't be expensive. And so that's why we made this a constant time operation. And of course, with the analysis, we don't use any amortized analysis here, and we don't need to, because you can't do better than constant time anyway. So, yeah. So let me just undo this back to the original version that we had for the analysis. Oh, actually, we're done with the analysis, right? So, yes. So I could go on and do more of this, but I think I can't get onto any more interesting data structure anyway. Well, I can without analyzing it. So I don't know what Peter's going to do next week. He has complete freedom. He may not continue this theme here. He may do something else. So let me just introduce you to skew heaps, because they're really, I find an amazing application of amortized analysis. And we're not going to do the analysis, but we're going to see the result of it. So. Yes, so skew heaps. And there are two data structures that kick off really this whole area of amortized analysis and self-organizing data structures. And the splay trees come next, but we will definitely not get to them today. And the idea is that when you insert something or you find something in the data structure, you modify the data structure in a way that makes it better behaved in the future. And this is also what the skew heaps do. And this is part of what you see is also in the Archive for Formal Proofs. And it's called a self-adjusting heap, and heap is priority queue. So there's this terminology that people often call priority queues heaps. And it's self-adjusting because it doesn't need any additional information to keep the heap in good shape. It just does it by a clever trick. And remember, we did have the leftist heaps, and they needed additional information. They wanted to know what the size of one of the subtrees is, and they could make the right subtree, and they always wanted to keep the right subtree short, and then the merge operation was short. Skew heaps will do something similar, except they don't need this information, and they don't guarantee it. They don't give you guaranteed worst case time, but only amortized time. So the same as for the leftist heaps, it has insert, merge, and delete min, and they all have logarithmic complexity, but only amortized. And same as with the with many of these mergeable heaps, the insert and the delete function are just defined via the merge function. So we don't need to look at them very much. This is the key function. So the implementation type is just an ordinary binary tree. And the invariant is that it's a heap, so always the smallest element at the root of each subtree. And the merge function, which is the key one, is this one. And I want to contrast it with the merge function for the leftist heaps, which is the same for that situation. If one of your two trees is empty, then your merge will just give you back the other tree. What did the leftist heap do? Well, actually, let's first look at this one before we get to the leftist heap. So here the idea is that you swap subtrees when descending. What does that mean? So in the leftist heaps, you also sometimes swap subtrees, but that depended on size information. Here you always swap them, and that has a good average behavior. So this is the merge function. This is the subtree on the left. This is the tree or the heap on the left, the heap on the right. And then, of course, you have to compare A1 and A2, the elements at the top. If A1 is the smaller one, then you build a heap, a tree with A1 at the root. And now what used to be the left subtree, L1, becomes the right subtree, and the merge goes into the left subtree. And similarly, if A2 is the smaller one, then A2 ends up at the root of the returned heap. And now L2 is made the right subtree, and the merge goes into the right subtree R2. And in both cases, the other one of the two heaps stays unchanged, H1 or H2. And otherwise, we always go into the right subtree. So one of these two trees or heaps will get destroyed because we take out the A1 or the A2, and the other one will get preserved, and then we recurse of the one that we've destroyed. We put the left subtree into the right part of the result, and we recurse on the right subtree, but on the left side. So that's where this swapping happens. So just for comparison, I'll write down what this merge would look like for the leftist heap. So it's again, I'm not going to copy down the right side again. And then it's also, if A1 is less or equal A2, and I will just give you that case. And then you have a node here, So this was the auxiliary constructor, which actually made the decision whether to flip subtrees or not. And it'll be node L1, A1, and a merge of R1 and T2, which is H2 in that. And so here the left one, the L1 stays the left one unless, because the node function, I'm leaving out the additional information that the leftist heaps have on the size, just pretending they're not there. But somehow this information is there, and therefore there's a case distinction if, and then in one case, you really build the node LAR, and in the other case, you build the node RAL, depending on the sizes of L and R. And in the leftist heaps, this node, this choice is taken depending on the sizes. Here, there is no choice. You always swap, and the L1 ends up on this side, and the merge ends up on the other side. So that's the only difference, but that's the key difference. And then, subtrees are always swapped and no size information is needed, which is nice. You save space. And the functional correctness proof is straightforward. We don't need to bother with that one. And this is the key theorem with which I want to stop, that tells us that the amortized complexity, what is that? That's the actual time for the merge plus the potential difference. And here we have the situation that the merge function takes two data structures. And so it's the potential afterwards of the merged data structure minus the potential of the two data structures that went into the merge. And it's bounded by 3 times the logarithm of the sum of the sizes of the data structure. So merge is logarithmic. And hence, so are insert and delete min, because they are defined. The proof I'm not going to go through, there's just no time. And they are defined in the same manner as before, so therefore their insert, the insert is also logarithmic with another addition, and the delete min is also logarithmic. And remember, in case you've forgotten how insert and delete min worked, here we are somehow. Yes. I see it is actually. Assume we have merged, you can define insert by merging the tree with a singleton element, and delete min is very trivial. You take out the top element and you merge the subtrees. Okay, that really brings me to the end. And any final words? Not really. I'm not prepared for them. Not yet end of term, but unfortunately I won't be away. I will be away next week, so hopefully Peter has some nice end of term words for you. Otherwise, I do enjoy teaching this course, and thank you for coming, and all the best with your exam on the Monday. I think it's right away. Yeah, I'm not there on Monday. But, so that's it. And of course, we hope that one or the other of you is also interested in doing a practicum, following up on this course.